When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is At The Turn. It's time for discussion and interviews about the world of golf you won't hear anywhere else. Here are your hosts, Nick Heidelberger and Joe Simons.
Hello, hello. Welcome into another episode of At The Turn. Nick and Joe with you. Get ready to lay up because we are managing the course today, Nick. Course management 101 with a 9 handicap and whatever you are
20,
right now.
20-something.
Okay, great.
20-something handicap. Yeah, no, I thought, I was like, this is really interesting. I wonder if our patrons are asking what I do around the course strategy-wise to maintain that impressive 20-something handicap. So I came up with some things that I do, but mine's not going to be like, you need to do this as much as like, hey, here's what I do. Am I doing this wrong? I've got one. It's a situation that I've never figured out. And it's come up a couple times already this year that I want your advice on. And the answer is probably just play better, Nick. But I'll bring that one up a little bit later.
I'm waiting with bated breath. We are going to have some final Masters thoughts as well. Before we get to any of it, a reminder to please rate and review the podcast. Give us 5 stars. Let us know how you manage the course. What are your tips and tricks for shooting your best score as we approach the heart of golf season? Speaking of which, Nick, I didn't write it down, but it is time very briefly for the handicap report. It's brought to you by Jason Day's Malbon sweater that was outlawed at Augusta National. Congrats to everyone for being super chill at Augusta as usual.
I have a question on that, actually.
Yeah.
So he was wearing this like big, I don't want to say obnoxious sweater, whatever,
yeah,
it was.
Big block lettering that said, yeah, Malbon Championship Golf on it.
Okay. Is that the one they asked him not to wear?
I think so, because he definitely wore it.
Exactly. He wore it like for the whole round that I could see. So like after the round, were they like, hey, you need to take that off? Like, or did they say like, okay, he wasn't going to wear it again the next day. So I'm just confused as to what they actually made him do.
Well, as I understand it, the story was they asked him to remove it. And judging from...
Get it off the property.
Put it in this oil drum over here and light it on fire. I was a little perplexed by that myself, but I think the main takeaway is that Augusta National still with a huge stick right up their collective bum. This is the course that banned Gary McCord for life as a broadcaster because he said the greens were so fast they looked like they were bikini waxed. And he goes, banned for life because of one little snide comment on a broadcast. So not a great sense of humor out there. We'll get to some more Masters thoughts in a second, but Nick, tournament season starts for me this weekend. The PDX Best Ball is happening at Rose City Golf Club. 2 days of, I don't know, trying to break par with my partner. There's two psychopaths that enter every year and just blitz the field. I think they went 64-64 in just abysmal conditions last year. I made one birdie and it was on like a 470 yard par four. And I thought, this is going to come and get so many skins. And these guys both birdied that hole like on their own ball. So, oh, you know, God. I think we're all playing for second. I think if we shoot even par, it's going to be fun. But that, and then the season's kind of underway. And I'm curious where you are with your season because you're a part of the U of I men's club this year, right?
I am. I'm a pass holder. Haven't played much golf. I played 3 holes the week before last. I played 1, 2, 3 in one over par, and I thought I was just gonna shoot 78 every round the rest of my life. I played 15 holes last week, which was kind of a cool, like my first experience, just like couldn't get a full round in, but now you can post 15 holes pretty easily to your handicap, all that stuff. I did not shoot 78. But you know, I've got some, I know I sound like a broken record. It's got some really encouraging eye test results.
See, this is great. I'm very excited for this. I can't wait to have my eyes gaze upon these and hopefully see some results. The new driver that I got, I think I'm finally figuring it out. The ball is doing different things. It's going much straighter than I'm accustomed to, so I really have to change the way that I'm aligning. Good problem to have. That's enough about our games. Let's do some rapid-fire thoughts on the Masters. Before we get to the actual tournament, can we talk briefly about Captain Zach's latest scandal? This is just unbelievable stuff. So if you're unfamiliar, Zach Johnson was caught on a hot mic. He was playing the par 3 12th hole. There are no patrons behind the par 3 12th, but you have that huge amphitheater sort of around the 11th fairway, 11th green, and the 12th tee. I think he made a four-footer for a triple. He turned to the crowd and thought he was saying to no one in particular, fuck you, but it was caught on a very, very hot mic. He was asked about it after the round. He seemed completely perplexed as to what anyone was referencing, completely denied it, said he was saying it to himself, if anybody else. But if you watch the video one time, it is so absolutely clear. He turns his body 180 degrees, clearly says F you to all the patrons who were giving him a hard time, probably about the hole that he played, his Ryder Cup captaincy, his appearance on Full Swing, and general demeanor altogether.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a very sarcastic, like, roar, like as if he just made a two on the hole. Yeah. You know, gosh, I almost feel bad for the guy.
No, because, don't do it.
I didn't even see Full Swing. I heard destroyed his credibility. Gosh, it's so funny to see these guys with like such a squeaky clean image for so long. And then all of a sudden, like late in their careers, they're like completely villainized. I mean, like, it's not the exact same parallel with Phil, but like along those same lines, it's like for the last 25 years, Phil Mickelson was the highest echelon of like golf dudes. And now he's just like almost a joke. And like Zach Johnson, of all people, being like a golf villain is just kind of a funny thought. I think golf would be better off if we could identify the villains when they're 22 years old and just actively root against them during the prime of their careers, because it would just be more enjoyable. Like, why do we want every single guy to be like perfectly squeaky clean and then find out when they're 38 that they're a douche?
Well, to me, there's like two types of villains, right? There's like the Bryson Brooks villain, who are either like an outsider because they're such a weirdo and they flaunt convention, which is more of Bryson, or Brooks, who's like, golf is for nerds and I'm going to beat all you nerds at your stupid game. And then you have the guys like Zach Johnson and Phil and people like Shooter McGavin and David Sims, who are the movie character version of this, who are just duplicitous, right? They show one thing, but they're actually another thing. They're saying that they love women and children, and in the background, they're smoking cigarettes and throwing kids like autographs in the garbage and shit like that. Like, it's the honest villains, which I think we have some of and could use more, but then it's the duplicitous people, and you're getting more of that. Like JT, I think, is starting to fall into that category, although I think he's more sort of apparently a douche and then also more of a douche. Like his full swing performances are pretty rough too. But yeah, I think villains are good. Do you prefer the two-faced villains, or do you prefer kind of the weirdos like the Brysons and the Brooks?
I like the weirdos. You know what
Me
I mean?
Too.
Just let them. Like, think about the NFL and the NBA. Like, there's plenty of players who are not likable, but you know exactly why you don't like them. And that's fine. That's good for the game. It's not good to have, like, 100, like, clones of each other who are just, like, you know, boring and bland and you don't, I don't know. So, yeah, I like to know why I should be rooting against certain people.
Yeah, Xander and Patrick Cantlay aren't interesting or evil. They're just blah. Like, give me 15 Brysons. That's what was so fun kind of getting into the Masters, about Bryson being a character for 4 days. Like, even though he didn't win, he still had that crazy good first round. He shot a 2 under 65. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. I made that joke to you guys in the chat. Bryson's doing really good. He shot an even par 67. And then he had that crazy hole out to finish his third round. The wheels completely came off late in the third round for him. He chipped it into the water. He hit it into the water. Like, he was totally messing up. And then he laid up on the 18th, and he's like, oh, is Bryson going to finish the day in the top 10? And then he dunks one from like 100 yards. And just the idea of Bryson putting a green jacket on was pretty fun. It was good to see him be a character over the course of 4 days. And you said you watched mostly Thursday, Friday, so you must have seen a fair bit of Bryson.
I watched a lot of Bryson's round on Thursday. Yeah, it was entertaining. Like, I was enjoying it. I hate to even say this, but I was rooting for Bryson. Like, I was very interested in that storyline. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I would say out of all the guys who were kind of in the mix, obviously I was rooting for Ludwig the most because he was one of my picks. But I if not him, you know, Scotty is Scotty. But to see either Bryson or Max Homa, I think would have been two of the more interesting guys to get it done. Just kind of some rapid fire stuff because, you know, it's Masters was a couple days ago at this point. But Scotty, you said this in our preview, Nick, and I thought about it a lot down the stretch. Scotty doesn't need to play his best to win the Masters. And Scotty was far from his best, but when he needed to sack up and hit a big shot, he did that twice on Sunday. Ludwig tied him with like a 40-foot birdie putt on 9, and then Scotty in the fairway saw that happen and almost dunked his second shot, hit it to an inch. After everyone kind of screwed up on the 11th hole, Scotty screwing up the least with a bogey, Ludwig kind of righted the ship, and he made a birdie on 13, and he birdied 14 to kind of put the pressure on Scotty. And then Scotty hits 13 and 2, and then Scotty on 14 hits it to 2 feet and makes a birdie. So anytime Ludwig kind of applied a little bit of pressure, Scotty had that 3-shot lead coming out of Amen Corner. But anytime Ludwig would make a birdie or hit a big shot, Scotty would respond immediately. And that's what the Scotties do. That's what the Tigers do. They don't have to be perfect, but when it's time to sack up and hit the big shot, he did that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we've kind of glanced over this, but I did correctly identify the winner of the Masters in our preview. You know,
you did.
I didn't want that to be lost anywhere.
Going out on a limb,
buried it all. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of guys in that field, and you know, I picked one winner, and that was the guy who ended up winning. So, you know, let's not forget about that. But no, I mean, Scotty's on another planet right now. He's just head and shoulders above everybody else. The only way he wasn't going to win that tournament is if his wife went into labor, which didn't happen. Ashley sent me that on Saturday night, and it was like, I think the context was, if she goes into labor before the start of the final round, he's going to be out of here. And I'm like, okay, so the moment he tees off, he's like, I don't care what happens. Like, I'm going to win this golf tournament, which is cool.
Did you and Ashley run through that scenario?
You know, we didn't have to. Fortunately, Gavin was born in December, so I was not going to be on the golf course to miss my firstborn.
That's just good planning. In case you, well, like I said to Lace, you know, really the most realistic path for me to play the Masters is runner up of the mid-am. And we ran through the scenario of
the runner up gets that.
The runner up gets it. Yeah, if you're the runner up of the mid-am, that's the guy who was low amateur this year at Augusta, Neil Shipley. He was the runner up at the mid-am, and there's this really, really cool moment in his semifinal match where he hit it from the fairway to like a foot to lock down the match, and he realized, like, I just got my invite to Augusta, and he's like high-fiving everybody in the crowd and freaking out and stuff. And he ended up being the low amateur.
But I was talking with Tiger Woods.
Exactly. Play with Tiger Woods. I was talking with Lace about it. I said, hey, if I qualify for the Masters, will you wear the caddy bib? And she's like, well, how do you qualify for the Masters? And I ran through, like, you know, first I have to get my handicap down enough to, you know, go to sectional qualifying and then regional qualifying. And then I have to survive the field to be down to the 64 match play. And then I have to win 4 matches. And then I qualify for the Masters. And she says, okay, well, once you make it to the second stage of qualifying for the U.S. Amateur, then we can start talking about what my outfit will be for the caddy. And I said, that's fair. So we have a ways to go.
Totally fair. Well, you got the new driver now, though, so you're on your way.
Oh, baby, I'm hitting her good. One more thing for Lacey, and God bless her. We hung out and watched a lot of the tournament this weekend as we were putting together a new patio furniture set. And if you want to test your relationship, put together a new patio furniture set on the deck. Sure. She said when Scotty won, because someone said, Scotty Scheffler, the fourth youngest two-time Masters champion at 27, she put down her book and said, that guy's 27? No way, that guy looks 47. Yep, that's correct.
Yeah.
You know, look, I think Scotty, I think I'd be surprised if he won more majors this season. He hasn't had his A-plus game, and no one has really, like, taken it from him. There was an opportunity for someone to go out and shoot lights out over the weekend and win the Masters. And no one did it. The conditions were really hard. Scotty was there. Real quick on Ludvig. Speaking of sacking up, that dude was really the only serious challenger to him on the back nine, and he hit like three or four just manly shots. Hit a 4-iron on 13 over the water to like 10 feet, just missed the eagle putt. Hit a second shot on 14 to like a foot. Screwed up 15, screwed up 16, kind of took him out of the game. He really needed to run the table. But he was the only guy that applied any pressure to Scotty on the back nine. You know, Morikawa, Xander didn't do anything all day. It was a little bit unfortunate, but I was, even though I picked Ludvig, I was a little bit surprised how long he hung in there, Nick.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. I mean, it was, I'm glad there was somebody within a few, but it was really by the time, like I said, I watched Thursday, yeah. Friday, I watched the last hour on Saturday, and it was pretty much a foregone conclusion. Unless Scotty was going to, like, you know, four putt the last green. There was no way he wasn't winning that tournament.
He doesn't make the big mistake. I think that's all it is. Real quick, once again, I can't encourage you enough to please engage in betting the top senior if you do partake in the Masters. Just the most fun bet every single year. I had Jose Maria Olazabal, who, God bless Phil Mickelson, somehow beat him by one shot. Olazabal makes the cut on the number, and he shot even par yesterday. And Phil got up and down from the fairway from 115 yards to snatch it away from me. It was just devastating stuff. And it's so fun because it's like you have a tournament within the tournament. So Phil had a one-shot lead on the 72nd hole, hits his tee shot into the trees, pitches out. So if Phil makes a double, I win. If he makes a bogey, I still get half of my bet. So 10-1, still really good odds because I got Jose Maria Olazabal at 21. Phil hits it on the green, has a 15-footer, and hits it in with so much pace that if he missed the hole, it would have gone off the green. And the reason it upset me is because I know Phil, for good reason, did not give a shit whether or not he made that putt. So he just popped it in, dashed everyone's dreams who had Jose Maria Olazabal at 20-1 as the top senior. But what's going to be fun about this going forward, not next year, but the following year, Tiger's going to be in the senior division. So you're essentially going to have a wager that's going to be Tiger or Phil for like the next 10 years of the Masters. It's going to be good stuff. I love it so much.
That's awesome.
Final thing, unless you have something else.
No.
Nance's prepackaged line, I thought it was one of his worst.
Yes.
When Scotty won, he just said, his stardom confirmed. And it's like, come on, you had 12 months to write this, Nance. That's all you got?
He's won like 50% of his last 20 starts. Like, I think he's a star.
Were we on the fence about Scotty?
Seriously. You know, maybe like a new chapter or something, because like he's gonna have the birth of his first child, and he's a two-time Masters winner, and like everything changes, or like really anything. That was kind of lame.
One of his weakest for sure. Well, once again, the Masters, best tournament of the year. Can't wait, and only two people have a chance to win the Grand Slam: Nick Heidelberger and Scottie Scheffler. We'll see what happens on the PGA Championship. By the way, I want to stick with that bit, the underrated, overrated, properly rated for all four majors. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I love that.
Let's do it.
We'll have to dig a little deeper on like PGA championship traditions, but I think we can do it.
I don't know that we will. I can already think of a couple right now. Deepest field in golf, overrated, underrated, properly rated.
Okay.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned indeed. Okay, it's enough screwing around. Let's get to it, Nick. It's time for course management 101. Now, before we get to each of our five course management tips, I figured we'd go with Tiger Woods. Congrats to Tiger, breaking the record for most consecutive cuts made at the Masters. This bounces around the internet every so often. It's Tiger's five tips, the five things he tries to do in a round. Easier said than done. Number one.
At first, I thought these were your tips. And I'm like, come on, Joe. Let's put some effort into this.
No, this is Tiger Woods. So keep that in mind with these five. I'm going to rip through them and then we can talk about it, okay? Number one, no sixes on par fives. Number two, no doubles. Number three, no three putts. Number four, no bogeys with scoring clubs. Number five, no double chips. Which of these is the hardest and which of these is the easiest, do you think?
Well, for me, No sixes on par fives is the hardest.
Me too. 100%.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, depending on how I'm playing, maybe it's the easiest because seven and eight is squarely in play as well. Yeah, I'd say, and no bogeys with scoring clubs for me too, just because, I mean, that's, you know, amateur golfer, like my game's just not that tight to have a nine out of my hand and get it on and two putt every time. I mean, that's just not what my game is.
No, it's really challenging to me. No sixes on par fives is the hardest, just because on par fives, I want to be ultra aggressive because you think, well, that's where we make our birdies. But I think if we played it more conservative, we'd probably make more pars and birdies doing it that way rather than
have a better scoring average for sure.
Exactly. Yes. Better way to put that. The easiest one is just no double chips. Just chip it onto the green. I think that's a good one. I'm sure what Tiger means by that for someone of his excellence is let's not get too cute. Don't try to hit that ultra flop shot and not get it on the green. Take your medicine, put it 15 feet and try to make the putt. That's kind of how I interpret that one.
Yeah. Just get it onto the green. The fact is for recreational golfers, and I'm sure to a pros to a lesser extent as well, is no matter where you get it on the green, like if you're on the green, your chances of two putting are like 90%, right? Like unless you get it to 3 or 4 feet, you're still gonna two putt quite a bit. Like if you're from 6 feet, if you're an amateur, you're probably still 50% of the time gonna two putt it. And unless you're outside of 30 feet, you're probably gonna two putt it, right? So like why get all mad, or why try to like make a shot that gets to 2 feet and then risk chunking it or sculling it or whatever, when you can just get it to 15 feet, probably pretty easily, and two putt and move on.
Don't have to be perfect. Just look at Scottie Scheffler. Just hit all your iron shots to 20 feet and you're going to be fine. Just don't worry about it. Okay. Nick and I have 5 course management tools. If you want to be a 9.3 handicapper, or if you want to be a 20 something handicapper, this is what you have to do to manage the course properly. Do you want to ping pong these?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. My first, this is number one, number two, number three, and honestly, number four and five. This to me is the biggest course management thing that I always think about off the tee. Execution, sometimes. I always want to know, where can I miss it big? Is there out of bounds left? Guess where I'm never going to miss. I'm fine with a big poof ball to the right because it's inbounds. I have to understand the big miss. Is there trouble over the green? Guess what? I'm never going to miss. I'm never going to miss long. If there is a big error to be had on a hole, I am never going to miss that direction. I'll try to change my shot shape. I will dramatically line up to get away from it. I'm never going to miss big unless the reward is huge, right? If there's a big reward and I'm swinging well, maybe I'll take that chance on. But the biggest thing for scoring for me, understand where the big miss and avoid it at all costs.
This is huge. It's the biggest thing for me that I need to do better. Like I've missed like the last time I played golf, I hit it right into the big miss on like two out of two holes on a 5-hole stretch that instantly led to triple bogey. It was like as soon as I struck the ball, it was like there was no other possible outcome other than triple bogey. And it was like, well, why didn't you just do anything except for that?
Hit anywhere else.
Seriously. So yeah, that's a good one. My first one, it's kind of along these lines. So line up so you're on the tee box, right? And the tee markers are set like 10 yards apart. Tee up your ball on the side of the tee markers where the trouble is. So if there's trouble on the left, you tee up your ball as far left as possible. That way you're aiming away from the trouble. This is a Jack Nicklaus thing. This is not a Nick Heidelberger thing. I've also seen it from Hank Haney. Because you just create an angle that automatically steers you away from the trouble. So again, if the trouble's on the right, put your ball as far to the right on the tee box as possible. Then you're aimed away from the trouble.
I think that's a really good one. You're just creating the biggest angle possible to kind of, in conjunction with mine, of basically avoid the big miss.
Yeah.
This one is probably a controversial one for amateurs because I would say more often than not, the advice that is given on approach is take an extra club. How often do you come up short? More often than I'm going long. My number two course management tip is to leave it below the hole. This is a Bob Simon Senior special. He says, most of the time, and I have to agree, when you're below the hole and you're hitting up to the hole, you're going to be in better shape than if you're behind the hole and chipping back down to it. Now, of course, there's going to be situations where if there's water shorter, bunker shorter, obvious trouble short, this is not the play. But I always try to club down and take a more aggressive swing rather than club up and take a less swing, unless, again, there's another factor, like a headwind or something like that, where it makes sense to take an extra club. Leaving it below the hole to me is huge, and I find that I score way better when, even if I'm chipping from like 10 to 15 yards short, a lot of times that's better than just beyond the flag, like off the green to a back pin kind of situation where you're chipping back down. I'd always rather be short by a lot than long by a little.
Yeah, I think for the most part, this is pretty accurate. In my opinion, it does depend on the player, because most players miss it short, or not because of a strategy reason, but because of a ball striking reason. So like if you are playing a shot, planning on making perfect contact, then you should, and you're always missing short or missing short like 80% of the time, then take more club. And if one out of five times you're long because you hit it perfect and you had too much club, that's probably fine. That's probably, you're probably going to have a better scoring average than if you miss short 80% of the time. But generally speaking, you're way more screwed if you're long than if you're short. If you're short, you're probably going to have like some sort of uphill slope in your favor. You're probably going to have a nicer kind of pathway to the green. You're probably going to be like on the fairway or nicely mown, you know, easy to play from, rough or fringe. If you're long, like there's probably trees or water or like out of bounds or like really like rough that's not really kept, or you're like on like close to the next tee box or something. Just all sorts of bad stuff is long in the hole. So yes, if you're a good enough ball striker where like you know pretty good where it's going to go, great. If you're always short because you're always chunking the ball or just not making good contact, then you're going to have a better scoring average by bringing more club, because you're going to get more onto the green, and the few that go over aren't going to hurt you as much as all the strokes you're going to save.
Yeah, anyway, that's
my two cents.
No, that's a really good way to put it, because I think that sort of contextualizes, if you're constantly missing short, club up. If you're missing short intentionally and you're kind of on the edge and you're in between clubs but you're hitting the ball consistently, perhaps it behooves you to take less club, and that way you're chipping up to the hole.
Yeah. Okay, my next one, and I don't know, I'm curious if you do this or not, but I've kind of implemented a short game hierarchy. So when I'm off the green inside, I don't know, 25 yards, 5 yards, 10 yards, whatever it is, I have a hierarchy of club selection. So if I can use a putter, I'm going to use a putter. If there's a reason I can't use a putter, I'm going to use a 50 degree wedge. If there's a reason I can't use my 50, like I have short-sighted or have to go over a bunker or something, I'll use a 54. And if for some reason I can't use any of those, I'll use my 58. Now, this is something I kind of heard of like on a podcast over the off season. I dove into my data, and Joe, I know, like, I'm going to give you a data lecture right now.
Let's go.
I use ShotScope. I've got all sorts of proximity data, proximity by club, from yardages. I pulled up that data. So my 54 had always been my go-to club around the green, right? It's just whatever it was. My proximity, and I pulled out my data. So like when I use a putter from the short game, my average proximity is 7 feet. When I use a 50 degree wedge, my proximity is 10 feet. When I use my 54, my go-to club, my average proximity is 20 feet.
Wow. So like,
The clubs that I don't use by default are more than twice as good, twice as close to the hole on average than my go-to club. And my 58 average proximity is 22 feet. So just about the same as my 54. So
now, if I may real quick, do you know your sample size? Is it the same? Because I would assume your 54 is your highest sample size, so the truest data.
It is. That one is like quadruple. That 54 is like 156. And this is over my last like 20 rounds. So that's like 150 shots. The 50 was, you know, like 50 shots. The putter is like, you know, 30 or 40 shots. Enough to be relevant. It's not like three shots where I hit one good one. And you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's enough to be like, damn, like, why didn't I know this sooner? But it's really helpful. And the more I kind of implement this, I'm sure it'll level out a little bit. But it's very striking, because like anecdotally, we always lie to ourselves, right? Like, oh, I'm so comfortable with the 54. It's my go-to club. And like, you kind of either forget about the ones you chunk, or if I use a putter and I get it to like 9 feet, I'm like, well, what was a putt? Like it should be really close, but it's like, no, that's closer than I would get it with a wedge. So I've implemented this hierarchy with the short game. I don't have to choose what club I'm going to use every shot. It's like, okay, it's pretty obvious if I can use a putter or not. If I'm in the rough, I'm not using a putter, right? It's pretty obvious if I can use my 50 degree. Like, do I have enough room to let the ball roll? So it makes club selection easier. I'm never second guessing, and I have the confidence that I'm playing the shot that's going to get me closest to the hole.
Well, the last thing I want to do is disrupt your confidence. That's obviously the last thing I want to do. But here we go. and this is not aimed to do that, but this is something you must have considered. You're obviously using the putter on the easiest shots, and you're using the 58 on the more difficult shots. So yes, it stands to reason that your proximity is going to be less just by virtue of having more difficult shots.
100%. That's totally true. But doesn't that kind of validate? Like, if it's an easy shot, like, why would I use it?
Yes.
Why shouldn't I use a putter, right? Like,
agreed.
Right.
Yeah. I think we're saying the same thing, just perhaps in different ways. Like, if you're just off the green, yeah, a putter makes the most sense. If you just have like too much grass to putt through, then yeah, use like your least lofted wedge. If there's some trouble, use your sandwich. If you got to get the ball high or be really tricky or land in a specific spot, use your lob wedge. That's kind of your thought process.
Yeah, exactly. That does explain those proximities a little bit, but I also think it validates that club selection.
Yeah, it does. And I think it probably helps you a lot too to approach a short game shot and not have to like take a few clubs and think about it. You're like, I know that this is the best because the data backs it up, and I don't really have to think about the nuance. I can think about the execution.
Exactly. I used to drop my bag, grab my putter, 3 wedges, walk up to the shot, be like, all right, what am I feeling? You know, what's kind of speaking to me here? And it's like, no, dude, it's either this. And if it's not this, it's the next one. And you just go down and hit the shot.
Yeah. I mean, mine is much more caveman than that. I mean, I use my 56 degree to chip basically all of the time, unless it's a really, really delicate shot. And then I use a 60 degree. If I have to hit it low, I may hit like an 8-iron or a 9-iron. But by and large, I'm using my 56 all of the time. And I'm using my putter on the fringe unless it's like, unless I'm feeling really good with the sandwich and I want to try to knock one in, you know?
Yeah.
No, I love that, Nick. I love that. So that is basically, I guess, to encapsulate that, it's have a system with your wedges.
Yeah, I call it a short game hierarchy. It's just like.
Okay, this one is really simple. There's no nuance to this. If you're in a bunker, get it out of the bunker in one shot. Don't think too much about it. Don't try to hit a perfect shot. Colin Morikawa got a little bit too cutesy, and it cost him contending to the Masters yesterday out of a bunker. Just get it out of the bunker, okay? I mean, what's going to happen more often? Are you going to hit your bunker shot to 2 feet, or are you going to make a 15-foot putt more often? Just get it out of the bunker, put it on the green. Nothing feels worse than leaving it in a bunker. Just find somehow to get it out of a bunker. And Nick, in the winter here in Portland, successfully, I've putted it out of a bunker 3 times. When I find firm sand, I am putting out of bunkers now, and I feel like I'm like getting away. I think the golf police are going to capture me. Like, when you have the right setup to put out of a bunker, nothing makes you feel smarter or like you're getting away with something that's illegal. Like, the situation has to be absolutely perfect for it, but when it arises and you do it, that's actually a Jack Nicklaus one too. I had this really cool old illustrated book, and I saw him putting out of a bunker, and he's like, if you don't have a lip and the sand is firm, like, practice putting out of a bunker a few times, and once you validate to yourself that you can do it and you do it on the golf course, it feels like cheating, and it does. In any event, get that out of the bunker in one shot. Don't leave it in the bunker.
That's such a good one, because people get in the bunker, and I think maybe I shouldn't speak for everybody. Maybe I just speak for myself. It's like, holy crap, what am I going to do? What if it takes me 6 shots to get out of here? And then you tense up, you take a big whack, and you know, like, you're either going to kill the person on the other side of the green, or you're going to have the ball right back at your feet. It's like, just take the pressure off, lower the expectation, just get it out of there.
I would also argue, don't be afraid to scull it. I know that sounds crazy. Your fear should be chunking it. sculling it is not the worst thing in the world. Like, unless there's some terrible trouble long, like sculling it over the green, so what? You chip up and down for bogey. It's not that big of a deal. Leaving it in the bunker, which is the scary spot for a lot of people, to me, that's when the doubles and the triples and others come into play. Sculling is not the end of the world. Don't be afraid of sculling your bunker shot. How's that for a course management?
I feel like you've given me permission to scull out of the bunker, which feels liberating.
You're going to do that in the Corner Club Open. I'm going to say, good play, Nick.
Great play.
Well done. Mark's going to lose his mind. Yeah. All right. What's your third one?
It's putting routine. I want you to be consistent with your putting routine throughout the season and throughout your practice. Like, I started using a line, like, at the beginning of last year. I think I was going to use a putting line to line up my putts and yada, yada. And I didn't commit to it throughout my rounds. Like, I'd be like, I don't feel like doing it right now. Like, I'd either be like pissed off because I hit a bad shot and like just rushing, or if there was like a group behind me or whatever it was, I'd just like not commit to it. And I didn't really practice that way either. And I think if you're going to, whatever you're going to do on the course, you need to be committed to it. So if you only want to do it part of the time, you need to pick a routine you want to do all the time. And you want to practice that way too. Cause like, if you show up to the putting green, you just drop a few balls and just kind of hit some and just whatever, you're not really practicing what you're going to do on the course. So I think this year my putting practice has been a lot more game-like, and I think that really helps. So my suggestion is to have a putting routine, whether it's a line, no line, whatever it is, however you approach your putts, do it every time and practice that way.
I think that's great. And I'm curious about your putting routine, because something that I've always been really conscious of in putting is having a trigger to start the stroke. Like, lining it up and getting in front of it and the address and the routine, I think, is important too. But to me, one of the most important things that I have is the thing that starts the motion. And what I always do is like the really slight forward press, like just like a little bit, and that sort of starts the stroke. Do you have like a body motion or like a hand motion or a thought of like, do you look a certain number of times? Like, what is the thing that engages you? Like, does it just feel right? Like, obviously there has to be, I mean, there's gotta be something, right?
I take one last look at where I want the ball to fall in the hole. Mm. And then I think about my tempo. I kind of have like a tempo rhythm in my head and I just putt to the tempo.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, to me, that's like the last, like if you have a routine, that's like the last thing of a routine, right, is before the actual action happens. And you'll see some like Brian Hartman has his little twitchy thing where he looks 15 times. Some guys have the thing where they like pull their sleeve down, or Cam Smith has the thing where he puts his hand on his hip, and that's kind of the motion to start all of the motion. I would just encourage you to have some sort of motion as part of your putting routine to like make it automatic instead of like, oh God, when do I start putting? You know, because that creeping thought can be kind of freaky. My number four, again, really easy. Don't hit it out of bounds. Don't hit it in the water. Keep it out of the penalty areas. You see a penalty area? Hit it somewhere else. It's not out of bounds on the left. Ain't way right. Now, it's tough when you have, you know, out of bounds left, penalty right. Well, then you just got to make a good golf swing. You got to stand up there and hit it. But more often than not, you're not going to have penalty on both areas. Find where the penalty is. Don't hit it there. Again, very, very caveman golf. Do you get a penalty for hitting it left? Hit it right. It's fine.
This is my number four also. It's just to avoid penalties.
Yeah.
Like you said, most golf course architects give you a place to play. They want you to find the best way to play the hole. They don't want you to like have to hit a perfect shot on every hole. So like 99.9% of the time, like you said, if there's a penalty area on one side, you've got plenty of room on the other side. So this is also a sore subject for me. Like I said, I just gave away six strokes hitting it directly at penalty areas intentionally. So it seems like a good strategy not to do that.
Number five, this is the most difficult one that seems so easy to do, but to pull yourself out after making a mistake and to not continue to make mistakes on that hole is just the ultimate mental test of golf. Don't compound your mistakes. You hit it in the trees, just punch it out. Pop it on the green. Get close, two putt, make a bogey, even a double. Don't make a triple. Don't make another. We're not Tiger Woods. We can make a double. A double, you're going to recover from a double. It's fine. You birdie the next hole, you're in good shape. Don't compound your mistakes. Just get it back in play. This one's tough for me, Nick, because growing up in Oregon, there's a lot of trees, and I have a lot of practice hitting it in between trees and hooking it around this and slicing it around that, but I think I'd be better served to just punch out and take my medicine. Take my medicine, don't compound mistakes. Easier said than done.
Yeah, because you're always looking for a way to convince. Like, the first thing you do when you're in trouble is you look for the hero shot. Like, nobody goes into the trouble looking for, like, the punch out. They look for, like, okay,
there's
what's
window.
The ideal? They look at the flag. What's between me and the flag? Like, can I shoot that gap? And it takes, like, a heavy amount of convincing themselves they can't do it in order to even consider what the alternative is. And it probably should be the other way around. Like, hey, I hit a bad drive. I'm not going to make a par on this hole. Like, I think you just need to walk into the woods telling yourself, I'm not going to make a par on this hole. And once you accept that, then, like, if you can punch it out and advance it 40 yards, then you're like, okay, now I just have 100 yards in and I can easily make a bogey from there. But people, ourselves included, like, just try to smash that four iron through the trees and draw it around there and pull off that shot. And the worst is this, Joe. When you visualize that shot and you pull the club and you get an impact, and it's almost always the best strike of the day. It's absolutely flushed and it just nicks the very bottom of a branch and just dies straight down 20. And you're like, oh my God, if that was an inch lower, this would have been perfect. That was the best strike of the day. Why can't I hit it like that every time? And you're on your road to double.
The worst, it's so funny you said four iron, because I had one the other day where it was 18, and it's a 18 at Rose City is a really hard hole, and I had like 210 in, and I had the perfect gap for a four iron, like through the trees. I just striped it and it went to like 20 feet. And when you do that, it reinforces bad behavior. When you pull off the hero shot, it's almost worse than when you fuck it up. It's like Russell Westbrook in the NBA. I remember he played the Blazers a lot when I was covering the Blazers, and nothing was better than Russell Westbrook making a three early on in the game, because he was going to shoot them the entire game and he'd go like 1 for 10 or 2 for 11. They'd leave him wide open the whole game. He thinks he's going to make them. Pulling off a hero shot reinforces such bad behavior. It feels great. It's probably not very good for your golf game, though.
For sure.
What's your last one?
Okay. This is the one I need your advice on.
Oh, I can't wait.
I don't know. It's probably just like become a better golfer, because it's just like, I'm going to implement course management. I'm asking about course management because like I hit bad shots that are bad. So just like, maybe don't hit bad shots, but here it is. There are holes where when you're approaching the green, there's a clear like runoff area or false front that you have to, like, you want to avoid, like when you're chipping or say you're 40, 50 yards out and you're like, okay, like for example, hole number 11 at U of I, it's a very severely sloped green and it slopes, like if you hit it in the wrong spot on the green, like it can just run off the green on the front and there's a collection area down there. And so the other day I'm playing that hole and I'm chipping up. I'm like, okay, well, I got to get it past the hole because it's going to run, if otherwise it's going to run off into that collection area and it's going to go on the green and run off and be chipping again. So I hit it, you know, 20 feet past the hole. And then I putt down the hill and putt right off into that collection area. Like the putt just had no chance of stopping. And there's a few areas, and I think a lot of golf courses have a couple places like this where it's like, okay, there's going to be like a runoff or a kind of like a penal little spot here. But I'm walking back to my next shot. I'm like, well, would I have been better off just to be in this place in one shot than to avoid it and then it takes two shots to get to this exact same place? Or do I just need to like find a way to not put it off the green?
So what you're saying is, instead of avoiding the worst part of the hole, basically take, I think what you're doing is you are trying to mitigate the difficulty of the hole in the short game. Like, it's the sort of hole where you're going to have to hit a really good shot at some point to make a good score on that hole. So you're hoping you can do it in the short game. But I think what you actually have to do is have a better angle of approach into the green, because that hole specifically, you're hitting, the fairway is severely sloped left to right. And the green is sort of sloped the same way, but the shape of the green is cut the opposite way. So to play that hole, I always like hitting it to the left and you have more of a straight shot into the green rather than if you hit the fairway, you have this crazy slope and the green is thin. You have less angle to attack. So what I would say is you have to hit a really good shot at some point to make a good score on that hole. You either have to do it in the short game or you have to do it in your approach. It's just a matter of what you feel more comfortable with. To answer your question, no, I don't think that embracing the danger by hitting it in the bad spot early is the best way to play the hole.
Yeah, and I'm not saying like you should just hit it into the collection area. That should be your target just so you can just get it over with. But I'm like, I was so cautious that I was 20 feet long and I have this 20 foot downhill putt on like a really severely sloped green where like unless I hit it I don't know it's just really hard, like just that's just a really hard putt to keep on the green. I haven't helped myself by avoiding it. If I was not so afraid of taking on that risk, I could have tried to play it, you know, a shot closer to the flag, and if it doesn't work out and it goes into that collection area, oh, well, I'm there in one shot. And if I do hit a good shot and somehow get it within 10 feet, like that's great too. But rather than just being like overly cautious and, oh, I'm going to play away. And now I've got this impossible, you know, 20 foot putt coming down a hill that I'm never going to hold. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that sort of speaks to leaving it below the hole because short right is the collection area. Short left isn't really a bad miss on that hole. If you're short left, you're chipping back up the hill and can actually be a little bit aggressive. Sure, it's going to slope from left to right, but you can be a little more aggressive. So I think that sort of leads me to, all right, let's say you have 130 yards into that hole. What's 130 yards to you? A pitching wedge?
I'd be a 9-iron.
A 9-iron. Okay. So what I would say is hit a pitching wedge. Try to hit a pitching wedge hard. And like basically aim to the left side of the green no matter where the flag is. And so if you miss it short left, you're fine. If you catch it good and because you're a lefty and you pull it a little bit, well, that pull, it's going to go a little bit farther and you might be closer to the flag at that point. Like I would take, to me, a really aggressive swing with a pitching wedge on that hole. Aim a little bit left. If you hit it normal, great, you're short left. If you pull it a little bit, you end up in the collection area maybe, or you could pull it into a really good result.
Okay. I'll try that and keep you posted.
What was the overarching course management tip on that one? Did we have a fun little
no? That was just more of a discussion topic of just like
I
don't know if it's collection areas or like severely sloped greens or things you're trying to avoid.
Sure,
but you end up there like by avoiding it on your first shot, you end up there and it takes you two strokes to get there instead of like just taking on the risk on the first one.
It's almost like you're being overly conservative, and that is leading to a big mistake rather than trying to take something on at a certain point.
Right. Like I brought in more risk by eliminating the risk. Cause I,
yeah, no, I think that's it. I mean, and you make a really good point. I think on every golf course, there's going to be two or three shots where you know that you have to basically step up there and hit a golf shot. Like there's no course management or anything you can do. You're just going to have to step up and hit a golf shot. And I think that is one of those holes where you have to do that. It's kind of ironic because to me, the tee shot on the next hole at U of I is that spot. That's my least favorite shot on the entire golf course. And I always try to be conservative in that. I'm not making a double. And it's one of those things that like, just be really aggressive and pull up. Cause you're gonna have to pull off a good shot at some point. So you can either four iron and chip your way to a bogey or a double, or you can try to nut up and hit a big drive and a good second shot and make a birdie or a par. So yeah, it's a really interesting idea of being overly conservative leading to bad scores rather than trying to step up there and hit a golf shot.
Yeah.
Well, I hope all of you are now better golfers for having listened to this conversation.
Gosh.
Course management, it's easier said than done. It's tough. It's a really, really tough thing to do. And with that, let's get to a very special edition of Mad Golfer of the Week. It's brought to you by Piper Golf. Use promo code TURN10 at check out. Nick, I know you try to abstain from the social medias as much as possible. And, you know, I like to make little videos and post what we're talking about on the podcast. And, you know, occasionally they'll do pretty well and we get some comments. But, oh boy, there was a firestorm that is still continuing on the Instagram and the TikToks. I posted that little clip where we were having a little jokey joke about how the members of Augusta National Golf Club also get a green jacket in addition to the winners. And I made a funny about how, you know, the VP of finance for Hewlett Packard gets one, and we all had a good laugh about it.
That was the best part. I was rolling. I thought that was the best part of the whole podcast. Apparently, I'm in the minority there.
Well, we got a little backlash to it after I posted. Currently, there's over 500,000 views of the damn thing, so it's really kind of taken on a life of its own. And, you know, the life cycle of these things is pretty funny because I was way too much of a Twitter user when I was working covering the Blazers, and when things would pop, they usually go through the life cycle of it's popular, then there's backlash to the opinion, and then there's backlash to the backlash, which is kind of where we are now. Because at first, it was very, very popular, but then people are like, are you guys fucking idiots? You don't know how Augusta National works? How do you have a podcast? You guys are stupid. So all this kind of stuff is really, really funny. So I thought our Mad Golfers of the Week would be some fun comments from Instagram. The first is from Bookman Golf. Quote, way to broadcast your ignorance. Hashtag shrink the game.
Okay. I have to interject. I'm sorry.
Good.
To the people who think that we don't know how the green jacket works. That is not the issue here. We think it's stupid or just comical that the VP of finance for Hewlett Packard and Vijay Singh have anything in common. That's all we're saying.
It is very funny how people get green jackets, right? Vijay yes. Singh beat Tiger Woods. This guy has a good job with a company and is white. Here's another one. Okay, Jake Huber 94, quote, this is the best one. This is the best angry one. A bunch of randoms using daddy's money to start a golf pod that have no clue about Augusta, LMAO. Lacey was incensed by this. He's like, does this guy know how a fucking podcast works? You need a microphone and an internet connection to make a podcast.
If I had more daddy's money, I'd have a real microphone right now.
If I had daddy's money, I'd have a green jacket. And then the backlash to the backlash, which is where it started to get fun for me. This is from the Hill Jack, who says, quote, because we referenced Vijay in the video, Vijay cheated on the Asian tour, changed his scorecard, bum. That got me. And your winner, this is the best comment, this is the only comment that I liked because it was so good. L. Crandall 1212 wrote, how much shareholder value did Vijay provide? Which is really someone who's understanding the joke. Thank you to everybody who interacted with the post. It's still up there, doing way too well. It's quite hilarious. Congrats. You are all the Mad Golfer of the Week. And with that, it is now time for Nick Rolls, brought to you by Matchstick Golf. Use promo code TURN20 at checkout. By the way, you weren't alone. Dane Delgado also going out on a limb, picking Scottie Scheffler to win the 2024 Masters.
Smart man. Nick Rolls is pretty simple this week. I mentioned earlier, I played 15 holes of golf. I had to take my dog to the vet at 2 p.m. So I go on the night before. I'm looking to book tee times. I'm like, great. 8:30 would be great. 9 o'clock would be great. 9:15 would be fine. Earliest tee time is 10:09 a.m.
Ooh.
I'm like, oh, this is kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, maybe there's a PGM tournament before me. It's going to be slow. I get there at like 9:35. I'm like, Can I sneak out? They're like, no, it's packed. Can I jump out the back? No, they're doing maintenance. I'm like, all right. No, nobody cared that I had to take my dog to the vet. long story short, I got the dog to the vet on time. I played a 15-hole round, and I was fine with that. I'm like, I know they just changed the handicap. I think you already could have posted a 15-hole score, but now it's just more welcome than more invited. So I posted a 15-hole score, and it was just – my gin app just said, you're going to post a score and you're going to get a real differential. I said, let's do it. And I posted a score and I got a real differential. It was great. And I'm now more motivated to play golf, even if I know I can't get a full 18 holes in.
Yeah, I completely agree, Nick. I played a couple 9-hole rounds. You get the full differential. I haven't had a chance to go to any of the par threes that are now a part of this, but I do like how much more inclusive the gin app is going forward. It's very, very exciting.
On a somewhat unrelated note, I had to renew my gin. I joined the Idaho Golf Association. The U of I golf course is part of Washington Golf Association, and they're like just going through there. But I was comparing the two, and Idaho's was of course less expensive. Also, to compete in Idaho Mid-Am, you only have to be a 12 handicap. So I'm like, well, that's a good goal for me. So I am a new member of the Idaho Golf Association, and hopefully some year I can get that handicap and qualify for the Mid-Am before they change the requirements.
12 is so within your wheelhouse. Like, honestly, I'm not trying to put pressure on you, but I think you're going to be like a 16 or a 15 by the end of the year. Like, that is so within the realm of your possibility, especially like if you just get like a few rounds, like around 80 or like in the high 70s, which I know would be like a big monumental thing, and I'm not trying to diminish it. But like, I think once you break that barrier, you're going to find that you do it with maybe not regularity, but you're going to do it enough to where 15 is very achievable, Nick.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree.
I'm so excited. By the way, that's Nick Rules. Are we signed up for the Corner Club Open yet?
No, I was thinking about this yesterday. We need to get that entry in ASAP.
Okay. Why don't we do this? Whoever is closest to the Corner Club.
The next person to step inside the Corner Club, do the entry.
Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure to manage your game. Manage your time, manage your expectations, and have fun playing the game. Congrats to Scotty, congrats to Dane, congrats to Nick, all winning the 2024 Masters.
I'm Lacey Evans, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time at The Turn.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.